Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to the FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, April 24th, 2025, we're delighted to host a litigation update on Associated Press versus Budowich. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, I will keep my introduction of our guests today brief, certainly far more brief than their careers would deserve, so I highly recommend that if you're interested, you check out their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Tyson Langhofer, currently serves as senior counsel and director of the Center for Academic Freedom with the Alliance Defending Freedom, where he represents students and faculty at public high schools and colleges in defending First Amendment rights. Before joining ADF, Mr. Langhofer was a partner with Stinson LLP, where he worked as a commercial litigation attorney from 2000 until he joined ADF in 2015. Also joining us today as our moderator for today's conversation is Casey Maddox, who currently serves as vice president for legal strategy at Stand Together. Prior to joining Stand Together, Mr. Maddox's legal career focused on defending the First Amendment rights of students, faculty, healthcare workers, and religious organizations. And I will leave it there. A last note throughout the program, if you have any questions, please do submit them by the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so it'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. I'll ask that all questions submitted there, A, pertain to this discussion, and B, end with a question mark. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Mr. Maddox, the floor is yours.
Fantastic. Thank you, Kayla. And thanks to the Federalist Society for giving us this platform to talk about what I think is a very interesting First Amendment case. In my view, some of the most interesting and fun First Amendment cases are the ones where the actual practical result is not all that significant, right? It's the students who are told to turn your T-shirt on inside out. It's what seem like relatively minor free speech questions are sometimes the ones that I think can first of all be the most white hot in terms of the controversy around them, but also produce some really interesting case law. And so I think this is a great example of something like that. The Associated Press versus Budowich, which Tyson will talk about, and I will let him kind of kick off the conversation on the case. But I want to first of all just add to the introduction to Tyson. Tyson has been working we've known each other for very many years. Tyson is at Alliance Defending Freedom, doing free speech work at ADF, litigating largely most of your career, I think, litigating against universities that violate students' First Amendment rights. A lot of the issues that come up in this case also arise very often in the context of forums in the university context, which is part of why it made a lot of sense to have somebody who thinks about these specific issues, just not usually in the context of a forum in the president's office, for example, but very similar contexts that this often comes up. So Tyson is a great First Amendment attorney. We worked together for many years, and I'm excited to be able to talk with him about this case. So we'll turn it over to Tyson. If you want to give a brief kind of summary of what this case is about and where it is, and then we'll jump into questions. And as Kayla suggested, please do provide your questions. There are this is a very interesting case, so I'm sure there will be plenty of those. If you can drop your questions in the chat, we will make sure to get to those. So Tyson.
Absolutely. Thanks, Casey. Looking forward to the conversation. As you indicated, it is a fascinating case, which involves a lot of First Amendment aspects of First Amendment litigation. So give you a brief summary of the facts. The facts are the Trump administration asked the Associated Press to revise its AP style guide. And the AP style guide is used by many, many press organizations across the country to discuss you know, regular topics and how to refer to things and so forth. So they asked them to revise the AP style guide to refer to the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of America, which is consistent with President Trump's executive order that he issued back in January. The AP refused to do so. So the Trump administration immediately revoked the Associated Press's access to the press pool and other limited access events at the White House. The Associated Press then sued three officials in the Trump administration, and they argued that the administration's actions violated its Fifth Amendment due process rights, along with the AP's First Amendment rights. So after substantial, very expedited briefing and an evidentiary hearing, the district court issued a preliminary injunction against the Trump administration, ordering the Trump administration to allow the AP back in and to have the access to the press pool and these limited access events again. The Trump administration appealed that to the D.C. Circuit. The D.C. Circuit held an oral argument last week on that appeal and the preliminary injunction, but has not yet issued its opinion. So that's a brief overview, a very high level overview of the facts and kind of where we stand procedurally.
All right. So let's jump in. We do have this decision from the district court in D.C. That it's a 31-page opinion. It's a very, well, I guess it depends on how you print it, but it's a pretty thorough opinion. I think one of the questions that people have been asking about this case is trying to understand how the forum analysis works here. You get the questions about whether or not, you know, the AP has a First Amendment right to be in the Oval Office or things of that sort. Talk about the forum that's actually at stake in this case and why forum analysis matters.
Yeah, absolutely. That's key to understanding this question. So let me give you a broad overview of reporters' access to the White House in general. So you've got really two different types of individuals that are able to access the White House. First is the White House Press Corps. The White House Press Corps consists of over 1,000 members, and there's a rigorous application process to obtain what's known as a hard pass. Now, that hard pass allows general access to all White House press facilities from 5:30 a.m. to 10:30 p.m. on a daily basis. So journalists without hard passes, so you have the White House Press Corps consists of both journalists with hard passes and journalists without hard passes. Journalists without hard passes can attend White House events, but they've got to seek temporary day passes from the Secret Service. And the White House has long voluntarily opened certain spaces for hard pass holders to report on the news of the day. So really the forum we're talking about in general consists of of members of the press that possess a hard pass that can attend these daily briefings. Now, you'll hear a lot, and there's a lot of in this briefing about the Brady briefing room and the East room. So those two rooms are part of the facilities, the press facilities that are open to members of the press that have these hard passes. The Brady briefing room has 49 seats that 65 media outlets occupy, or they share to receive these daily press briefings from the White House press secretary. So that's what we see every day on a daily basis, where Caroline Leavitt comes out and shares with the press. That has 49 seats, and that rotates between 65 members of the media. Traditionally, the AP has had front row center seats in that room. So they got the premier, you know, they're right on the front lines there, you know, in the Brady briefing room. You also have the East Room. Now, the East Room can seat about 180 journalists, and they do that for press conferences or meetings with foreign leaders, like the president of Ukraine recently. And journalists can RSVP for East Room events through an online tool. So hard pass members, you've got people who are automatically in the Brady briefing room on a daily basis. And then you've got a broader audience from the East Room where you can RSVP kind of through a first come, first serve type basis. So that's the press corps. Then you go down to about 1-2% of the credentialed White House journalists, and that's the press pool. So the press pool is much smaller. And those, the members of the press pool, they attend limited space events in the Oval Office, in the Cabinet Room, and other places where they're invited by the White House. So they can travel with the president on Air Force One. They can attend other limited access events to which the president invites them, including Mar-a-Lago or his personal home, if they're invited to do that. Now, the press pool is kind of known as the eyes and ears of the full press corps. So essentially, they then communicate what they learned to other members of the press. Then you go down even more limited within the press pool. You've got the in-house pool, which attend most White House events and other small spaces. And that has about 21 members. And then the smallest iteration, they actually travel with the president on Air Force One. That has 13 members. Now, historically, the pool has four photographers. That's the AP, Reuters, AFP, and New York Times. And then they have three network journalists, radio correspondents, and three wire reporters and one print reporter. So that's the press pool. To be eligible to participate in that, you must be a hard pass holder. So the forum we're really talking about here, and what the AP is claiming that they were denied access to, is participating in the press pool and also participating in these limited access events, such as the East Room or the Brady Briefing Room, where people that are outside of the press pool also participate.
Got it. So it's this smaller universe that they can be. There are a lot of things the AP can still be present for, but not this, these sort of smaller events. And the East Room briefings is probably the largest of those, right? That they're excluded from.
That's correct. That's right. Yep.
On Air Force One at this point with the president and flying anywhere. It's those things. White House, like the Zelensky briefing, for example, when Zelensky was in the White House, the AP was out of that briefing, I believe. It's those things that they're being excluded from, but they're still present for some larger briefings.
That's correct. Yep. And there's really no dispute about that. I mean, the White House essentially agrees. Their main position is, look, your hard pass holders still have access to attend these events. There is no actual First Amendment right to be a part of the press pool. So that's really where the debate lies, is there a First Amendment right implicated when the White House specifically targets an individual press organization because of a disagreement over some viewpoint expressed by that organization.
So this is a under forum doctrine. Then talk about the way that the district court here sort of defines the forum at issue and what the rules are for that level of forum analysis.
Sure. So when the courts analyze claims about First Amendment violations on government property, they do it under a forum analysis. And there are a number of different forums that are available, or fora that are available, and they have different standards. So the first fora is what's known as a traditional public fora. And that would be a traditional public forum is one that it has traditionally been held open and used by the public to engage in First Amendment activities. And that would be like parks, streets, and sidewalks. That is the highest level, the highest standard of review. It has the most protection for individuals because everybody has access to to those events or to those spaces. And the government can only do that if they impose narrowly tailored restrictions in a traditional public forum. Then you have a designated public forum, and a designated public forum are government property that traditionally have not been designed for or held open for the public to engage in First Amendment activities, but the government has intentionally opened them up for those activities. And when that happens, they have the same exact standard of review. So they still have to be narrowly tailored, just like a traditional public forum, if the government opens it up to the general public for people to come in and participate. So that would be like say a community building, say some building owned by the government, say it used to be the city council, and then they got a new office and they decided, hey, anybody can rent this space out for an event that, meet these criteria. That would be a designated public forum, and the government would have to meet this narrowly tailored restrictions. Then you have non-public forum.
And there too. I think on the designated forum, most of the fights around like campus speech issues, for example, most of the issues in the campus context, student organization recognition, and all those kinds of fights, whether Ben Shapiro can speak at your university, most of those questions tend to be treated under the designated public forum. Kind of framing, right? Like university doesn't have to create a forum for student organizations. They all do. And when they do, then they have to play by certain rules because they have created a forum for student organizations to exist on their campus.
Exactly. That's right. And frankly, similarly, many of the schools don't have to open them up to non-community members, but many non-university community members, but many of them do. These huge universities, like I had some litigation against University of Minnesota regarding a Ben Shapiro event, and they had opened up almost all their facilities for use by community members, not just students and faculty. And so when they do that, they have expanded the forum, and therefore they have the same First Amendment obligations to members of the community as they do to students and faculty. So again, no obligation to open them up, but if you do open them up, then you have created obligations under the First Amendment in order to treat everybody equally.
All right, and then non-public forum, which I guess is the analysis here.
Correct. So the final type of forum is a non-public forum, and a non-public forum is a space that that the government hasn't opened up to the general public, but they have allowed certain limited access for certain individuals at certain times, and even in that case, the government. There are restrictions, even though they haven't designated it for everybody at all times to kind of come in and use this. They have certain restrictions. And the standard there is that the restrictions must be reasonable and they must be viewpoint neutral. So you, in First Amendment analysis, you have content neutral and viewpoint neutral. So content restrictions would be such as saying you can't discuss abortion in this forum. That would be a content-based restriction. If you said, well, you can discuss abortion, but you can't do it from a pro-life perspective, that would be a viewpoint-based restriction. And viewpoint-based restriction is, so it's a subset of content-based, but the Supreme Court has said, essentially, it's unconstitutional in essentially any forum. So if you're doing forum analysis, you cannot engage, the government cannot engage in viewpoint-based restrictions.
So the court here decides that this is one of these non-public forums, right? The government obviously doesn't make the Oval Office or the East Room or Air Force One available for the general public, not even for media generally, but it does allow sort of certain classes of media to come into those spaces and to ask questions of the president. And so if they do that, then this reasonable, basically the restrictions then need to be reasonable and viewpoint neutral. How does the court, the district court here sort of process the question of viewpoint neutrality and what did it determine?
Yeah. So, and you'll have to excuse me, my computer's freezing up for some reason, and so I'm not able to scroll down to all my notes. But the bottom line is what the court did is they first, and this is on a motion for preliminary injunction. So this is not a final order; it's just a motion for preliminary injunction. So the court is analyzing, a likelihood of prevailing on the merits at the actual. At the end. So what the court did, they looked at the First Amendment claims, First Amendment viewpoint discrimination. And it first looked at what type of forum we're dealing with. So is forum analysis even applicable? Because it's a little bit you know, unclear whether it's actually applicable. And so it actually looked at the nature of the what the government's done here. And it held that the White House press pool and the limited access events were both non-public forum. So they were not open to the members of the general public. There were limited access, kind of not invite only, but limited access. And it was a non-public forum. And so any restriction imposed by the government has to be reasonable and viewpoint neutral. So then, but there's some, the government actually pushed back and said, look, you shouldn't even use forum analysis here. And basically pointed out that the Oval Office and Trump's Mar-a-Lago home, where some of these press pool are, they're like intimate spaces. They're spaces that are very, very limited based upon security access and things like that. And their position is this isn't a forum. We have very limited access, and it's not similar to, say, a public building that the government has allowed certain members to use. The court rejected that argument and said, no, this isn't similar to somebody's bedroom or something like that, like the president's bedroom. It's because he's invited these individual members of the public in. They are invited in for a specific purpose. And when you do that, when the government does that, then they have to do it on a viewpoint neutral basis. And so any restrictions that are imposed on either the press pool or these limited access events have to be viewpoint neutral.
Yeah.
So the other interesting thing there is that so the government first argued that, well, it's this is not any kind of forum, right? They're denying that. But then there was this discussion about whether it was actual government speech. They're saying, hey, is this government speech? So another important aspect to understand about this is the government has the right to speak on when they want to speak. They can't, and they have the right to speak through who they want to speak through. They don't have to speak through, individuals dictated by the members of the public. But the court held, look, these restrictions they're not government speech. You are really curating who gets to speak from a private perspective, right? The AP is not a government controlled outlet. The government has its own White House press briefing. It has its own press secretary. It issues its own media releases. So this is not government speech. The curating of these press reporters is really a restriction on private speech rather than government speech. And that's why we apply a forum analysis. And because you invited them in, this is different than some private access event.
Well, and I think the court in its opinion notes that the government ends up ultimately expressly disclaiming the idea that this is government speech, because that question has come up from a few folks that, well, but isn't this government speech doctrine? The government basically disclaims that this is a government speech case, in part because the last thing, this is my guess, the last thing that the administration wants is to be seen to be wrapping its arms around the idea that the press is just there as a mouthpiece for the government, right? For the government's own message. That would undermine the entire purpose of being able to speak to the press if basically everyone believed that the government was only talking to the press to use it as a vehicle for whatever the government wanted to say, and was just speaking through reporters. Setting aside the fact that no one who has ever read any coverage of not only this administration, but any administration would think that it is simply just speaking for the administration. So they are disclaiming that, and you're left with this viewpoint neutrality point. One of the questions that I've seen a lot of people ask, seen a lot of people saying, and I believe that the government argued, this isn't a viewpoint neutrality. They're not discriminating on the basis of viewpoint. They're discriminating on the basis of facts. The argument is that the administration has said that this is the Gulf of America, and it has gone through the proper process to change the name into the Geological Survey to the Gulf of America. And so when the Associated Press refers to it as the Gulf of Mexico, it's actually making a factual error. And so they're being sort of discriminated against on the basis of sort of incompetence or failure to report the truth. How does the court deal with this question, whether it's viewpoint or an error of fact?
Yeah, I mean, frankly, the government doesn't really lean into that argument very much. They essentially admit that this is a viewpoint-based, you know, decision. Essentially, they essentially say, "Look, they're not being given the same access because they won't change their AP style guide," and they're not really claiming that that's not a viewpoint-based decision. It really is, but the fact is, and so there's not really a an argument about whether this is true or not. But here's the fact. Even if it did, that would really be more of a compelled speech claim. And they have made a compelled speech claim, but the court didn't address that, because really what it would be is, you know, the AP, if that was the claim and how the court would analyze it, is the AP would be saying, this is the Gulf of Mexico. Trump would be saying, this is the Gulf of America. And you must say what I want you to say, which is compelled speech. And that's still a First Amendment analysis. And the fact is that the First Amendment actually does protect false speech. It protects it. Like it does not, there is no, the government doesn't get to determine what's true and what's not, and then prohibit what they think is not true. Now, obviously there are implications. If you engage in false speech and you defame somebody, then you could be personally liable for that, right? And there can be harm for false speech, and certain types of false speech can be prohibited, such as false claims about, you know, your products and things like that. You have, you know, there are some laws on that. But in general, false speech is not prohibited. So even if that was an argument that was being advanced by the government, it probably would not prevail. But the court really didn't analyze it, because essentially, the viewpoint decision wasn't really the linchpin. The linchpin really was about what the form analysis, right? And then was the AP harmed by this, right? That's really where we're, you know, we get into it. And one thing I think that's important for us to understand, that these facts here that I didn't hit as much as I would like to about the access. The press pool has historically never been determined by the White House. The members of the press pool is actually determined by the White House Correspondents Association, which is a private entity. And they have their own method in determining who gets that access. And so, and the White House has historically allowed that and been okay with that. And given that they allowed that, the framework that was being allowed, you know, they can't shut that down if it's based on a viewpoint. So an interesting aspect of this case, I think, you know, that people want to talk about is the White House does have the right to take back control to determine who is a member of the press corps. And the AP actually consents to that. They say, you're right. The White House does have the right to determine who is a member of the press corps. The key dispute is, can they do that on a viewpoint-based basis, right? And the AP claims that the White House's new rules are designed to discriminate against the AP on the viewpoint, and the White House obviously denies that, but that's really the key dispute there.
The Shurtleff case. I think we alluded to this earlier. You have this Supreme Court decision recently that I wanted to see if you could speak to, the Boston case with flags that some people will recall. But it seems to me that's probably relevant to this case. I wanted to see if you could give the kind of brief background on that case and how that ends up having some relevance here.
Sure. So, well, the Boston case, it deals with a situation where the city of Boston, they had a policy. They had three flags out front. I think it was the Massachusetts flag, the state of Massachusetts flag, the American flag, and then they allowed community groups essentially to put up, to request to fly a different flag. And there was a denial of a Christian flag to be flown there. They claim, establishment clause issues. And the Supreme Court held that by the act of the city opening up the ability for members of the public to fly a flag, they cannot discriminate on viewpoint basis. So, obviously nobody would believe that they have the right to go tell a city, hey, fly my flag in front of the city council, right? That's not a traditional public forum. It's not, it's not something in a way that you would think you had the right to communicate. But given that the government opened it up, they have to open it up on a viewpoint neutral basis. And that's really the linchpin of all of First Amendment analysis. It's kind of the baseline. The First Amendment and the way the Supreme Court has interpreted it is that the First Amendment has a baseline. And if the government is imposing restrictions on speech, they cannot do it in a viewpoint based manner. So obviously there's a lot of parallels here, right? You have a flag in front of a city council building, which nobody historically believed was open to speech, but they open it to it. So it must be viewpoint neutral. Same thing. The Oval Office is the antithesis of what would be an open facility for people to come into, right? There are very few people who get to go in there. But when the government opens that up to individuals to speak, they must do it on a viewpoint neutral basis. And that's really the heart of the court's analysis here is this notion that, you don't have to open it up, but when you do, you must do it on a viewpoint neutral basis.
Yeah. One of the questions, we have a question that in the chat on this, I think one of the things people have tried to grapple with is what exactly is being denied the AP? What is the burden on speech? And so the argument will be, well, look, you're still able to report the news, you're still able to express your viewpoint. What exactly is the burden involved in a case like this?
Yeah, it's very interesting because, again, one interesting aspect of the press pool is, as I said earlier, the press pool are the eyes and ears of all the press. So once they come out of a press briefing, they share the information with all these other outlets, right? And so one of the prime arguments that the Trump administration argued is, hey, look at all of the stories that the AP is reporting on these events held at the White House, which they say they've been denied access to. How have they been harmed? They have pictures. They've got stories. They've admitted that we haven't even changed the tone of the media, the content of their stories. So how have they been harmed? That's the White House's argument. At the preliminary injunction hearing, the AP presented two live witnesses. The government didn't present any. They just presented some affidavits. And at that preliminary injunction hearing, the AP presented substantial evidence that they had been harmed. And basically what they're saying is this. They said, when our reporters and our photographers are in the Oval Office, they are reporting in real time. They said it takes between 30 to 45 seconds to take a picture in the White House and then release it publicly. It literally, their reporter and their photographers have three different phones that are attached out, that are, wired in and ready to release. And they break news inside the Oval Office, inside the Brady Room, the East Room, all those things. And so what their argument is that if they are required to wait until after all of the press pool leaves and then gives them information, they have been harmed. Because what's the AP is a wire service, right? So their service, they basically have subscriptions. The other media outlets subscribe to their wire service and get information. If the AP can't deliver real-time updates and good quality photos that are consistent with AP standards, then they're being harmed. And they actually presented substantial evidence that they've lost $150,000 advertiser who said, I'm no longer going to advertise with you because you can't give me real time updates. They had they've indicated, and there are multiple people who've reached out and said, we're having to go with other wire services right now because you can't give us the real time access that you once did. So the what they're claiming the harm is, yes, we get information, we get access eventually, but it's not as good. The quality is not as good. And it is literally harming our business because people pay us for immediate access and we don't have that immediate access any longer.
Yeah. Well, and then you also had that's very valuable. There's also sort of this question that often comes up in the First Amendment context, right? Like almost sort of separate and apart from the hard kind of hard arguments like that of the cost. There's one of the arguments that will often come up is basically, well, but you can exercise your rights in other ways, right? You're permitted to exercise your rights in other ways. In the campus context, it would be, well, you're not allowed to be a recognized student organization, but you can still continue to exercise your First Amendment rights in other contexts, off campus or as a group of individuals or things like that, right? Or you can't use this facility, but you can still rent another facility somewhere else. And so therefore, your rights are protected. How does that argument end up flying? The sort of you're still being able to exercise your rights in other ways.
Yeah. So this really kind of comes in under we've been talking about it, the First Amendment claim in the viewpoint discrimination side. This really falls under the First Amendment retaliation claim. And in the First Amendment retaliation claim, essentially the government doesn't, in that context, the government doesn't have to grant a benefit to somebody. But once they grant a benefit, if they withhold that benefit in retaliation for somebody engaging in their First Amendment rights, that is a First Amendment violation. And so that's really what we're talking about here is you're right. There are many, many reporters that don't have access to the White House. So the AP is just on the same, they're on the same playing field as those other reporters. But there is a benefit being given to certain reporters. And the AP is claiming that they've been denied that benefit, which admittedly they don't have to be given, but they've been denied it in retaliation for their speech. And once that happens, then that is that's a cognizable First Amendment violation. The court found that not only did they prevail on their First Amendment viewpoint discrimination claim, but they also prevailed on their First Amendment retaliation claim. And the retaliation claim is important because it's not there's not any forum analysis necessarily in there. That's more just on the, did the government engage in action which would chill a person of ordinary firmness to stop their speech or to harm them in some way in response to your First Amendment, speech. So that the court found that they had engaged in, both retaliation and viewpoint discrimination.
All right, we're going to go to a question here from an anonymous attendee, which I'm a big fan of because I'm a big fan of anonymous speech. And so anonymous attendee is asking a question, I think, that kind of gets to a lot of what people have been asking about this case. So that if I'm a Facebook influencer, I want White House access to be able to provide real-time news updates. Do I have a constitutional right to access so that denying me that would constitute an injury? So the question I'll kind of pose out of this, connected with that kind of hypothetical, is what the actual upshot of this decision is in terms of basically, does this mean that because the court has sided with the Associated Press, that the Associated Press necessarily then gets access to the Oval Office, to the East Room, all of those things?
Sure. Yeah. And actually, I'll read from the first page of the court's order, because I think it summarizes it well. It says, this injunction does not limit the various permissible reasons the government may have for excluding journalists from limited access events. It doesn't mandate that all eligible journalists, or indeed any journalists at all, be given access to the president or non-public government spaces. It doesn't prohibit the government officials from freely choosing which journalists to sit down with for interviews or which questions they answer. And it certainly doesn't prevent senior officials from publicly expressing their own views. So let's break that down a little bit. One of the big cases that's talked here, talked about in the opinion, and which the White House relies on a lot, is the Baltimore Sun case. Very interesting case. So in Baltimore Sun, the two reporters from the Baltimore Sun sued the governor of Maryland because the governor of Maryland didn't like their reporting on him and his administration. Governor of Maryland admittedly told every one of the government officials that you cannot speak to these two reporters. You're prohibited from doing so. They sued, and the Fourth Circuit actually ruled in favor of Maryland, the governor of Maryland. Why? Because the First Amendment does not give the reporter the right to question a government official or to force them to sit down to an interview. Doesn't give them the right. Well, I mean, they can question them, but that doesn't force the government official to respond to that or to choose them to interview them. So there's this First Amendment carve out. I mean, I guess it's not a carve out. It's just that the First Amendment doesn't apply when government officials decide not to interact with a certain reporter or even a whole outlet because of how that outlet reports. That's not governed by forum analysis. It's a very different situation when the government opens up a facility and says, hey, members of the press, you can come in and you can participate. When they do that, then they have to do it on a viewpoint neutral basis. Similarly, they have the right to determine the rules of that forum, right? And that's what's being done here. They get to determine which room they open up. So if they open up a room that has 10 seats, as opposed to a room that has 1,000 seats, obviously that's going to limit the number of reporters that have access. Only 10 can do it. So then you got to figure out, okay, how do they determine who those 10 people are? Well, they can do it on any number of bases, as long as it's not a viewpoint-based decision, right? So, and it has to be reasonable. So they could, do it any number of ways. And that, even if that way impacted an organization more heavily than another organization, as long as they can, the government can show that it wasn't, they didn't do it because of that viewpoint of that organization, then they would have the right to impose those restrictions. So, you know, if you are a Facebook influencer, if you don't meet the criteria that the government's laid out for this access to this forum, then you don't have the right to access it as long as they didn't target you for your viewpoint. For the East Room, all 1,000 members of the White House press corps are eligible to attend that. But not everybody gets in because there's only 180 seats, right? So, and that's what the fight is over right now. After the injunction was issued, the White House revised its press pool rules. And so the AP actually asked the court to move to enforce the injunction because they claim that the White House is still enforcing it in a manner that violates the injunction. The court actually denied that motion, and it didn't do it in a written opinion, so it's unclear, just did it on the record of the hearing, and the transcript's not released yet. But it appears that the AP was unable to show evidence that these new restrictions are being enforced in a way that's viewpoint-based against the AP.
So as far as we know, at least it appears as of right now, the AP is still not this decision was, 2 weeks old. The AP is still not in these spaces at this point.
It appears that they are not being given the access to the press pool that they had previously been given. And remember, the press pool is that 21, the 21 people and the 13 people that have these different access to these very, very small intimate gatherings. It appears that they don't have access there, but every one of the AP reporters still have a hard pass and they still can access these, the Brady briefing room and the East room, provided that they meet the, you know, they RSVP and so forth. Now they're claiming that they're being denied on a higher basis than other reporters that maybe didn't RSVP and things like that. And if they can show that, then that might be a claim. But as of now, it doesn't appear that they have the evidence to demonstrate that the new rules of the forum are being enforced in a discriminatory manner.
Which is, I think, many of the questions in the Q&A and that you'll see online about whether the focus of the question is whether the AP has a First Amendment right to press briefings, or something of that sort. That isn't specifically what the court decided. If it had, then the AP, you know, if it decided with the AP, then that would mean that the AP must be present. What they decided was. Do you have a First Amendment right not to be discriminated against on the basis of your viewpoint in accessing those things, which still leaves the administration with, the ability to decide, we just don't want wire services for whatever reason. You've got to then argue whether or not that's a reasonable restriction. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but they can exclude them for that basis. They can exclude them on the basis of reverse alphabetical order of your organization. That might be harder to defend from reasonableness perspective, but it would probably leave the Associated Press out, right? There's probably a lot of different ways that this still can play out and will continue to, but at least under the existing decision, viewpoint is the thing that's excluded. One of the other questions Jeffrey Wood asks, basically, the degree to which the definition of the press ends up mattering here. I think, you know, one of the part of the argument is that this is sort of seeking a special right to access for professional journalists. I believe that the way this situation has played out is that the administration has been and I think the court ends up saying this, that the spaces that were there for the AP are now being basically filled by new media sources that have benefited from pushing the AP out of these spots, at least like in the East Room, right?
Right.
But what's the relevance, I guess, of any of kind of the definition of what is the press, what is the media in this case?
Well, there really wasn't any discussion in the opinion or any of the briefings about the definition of press. I don't think anybody, there wasn't any real dispute between the parties or in the court over the definition of the press for a couple of reasons. I think one, obviously, there can be a lot of dispute over what new media maybe is press, but the AP is clearly the press. I mean, they're one of the oldest organizations. They've got, you know, journalists, they've got photographers. What they do, I think anybody would say is part of the press. Now, but the other reason why it's not that important, frankly, is that forum analysis, under forum analysis, both the members, the press doesn't get any more access than the members of the public. They, just because there is the freedom of the press in the First Amendment, does not mean that the press automatically gets to go and ask government officials questions that the public couldn't. Okay, so it doesn't really matter for that purposes. The only reason it really matters is for the definition of the forum itself, right? Because remember, when there's a non-public forum, the government can open it up even to limited classes of people. So, or content. So it could say, we're going to open up this library room for discussions about science on Thursdays. And if they wanted to do that, you couldn't come in and say, well, I want to talk about history. They say, no, this is about science. You can have a content-based restriction in a closed forum or in a limited public forum. Here, you could also restrict it to certain classes of people, such as universities could say only students can use these classroom buildings, right? They can do that. Here, what the government has done is they said, we're going to allow certain people access to press facilities, and they get to determine who those people are. And in this case, the reason that's not a fight is because the AP meets all those requirements. So there's no real dispute that they meet the baseline requirements to have access to the press facilities. The question is, can the government deny it to the AP people because they disagree with the AP style guide?
Got it. I promised nerdery here. So if people somehow don't think that they've gotten enough nerdery, there is also the question one of the conversations that ends up coming up in this opinion, which is, I thought, pretty impressive considering the Judge McFadden had this case for about a month. Pretty long discussion about history and the original public meaning of the press clause. And some of the sort of disputes in the early, early days of the Republic. I wanted to see if you wanted to comment on that.
Yeah, I loved that aspect too, because I think one important, as we are living in, in many ways, we like to think we're living in unprecedented times. And these are, you hear lots of that, like these are unprecedented times and there's never been the kind of threats to the democracy that we've had and these types of things. But when you go back and read the history, there was the court talks about not only the debates over the language of the Constitution itself, right? And there was these, there was a whole cadre of people who were saying, we're not going to vote for the Constitution unless you specifically protect freedom of the press. And so once they get through those debates, because there was a lot of people who didn't even want to do that, they thought it might be more harmful to actually lay that out. Once they get there, immediately upon the Constitution being approved, you have a congressman who submits a bill to basically ban these members of the press from being reporting and being present during these congressional debates because he didn't like what they were reporting. And there's a whole discussion about how that congressman was rebuked by none other than James Madison, who said, look, it's improper to throw impediments in the way of the reporting. No matter what you think about it, this is an important part of our democracy. And so I think what I love about that aspect of the opinion is I think it just puts this in context that this isn't the first debate we've had on these issues, that these debates have been resolved in the past, and we can continue to resolve these debates. And this just gives us another opportunity to further define the contours of, what is the freedom of the press mean? What limits does the government have in imposing access? And frankly, it still gives the government, even under this ruling, a lot of opportunity to frame its message, right? To get its message out. The Trump administration still has the ability to determine who they give exclusive interviews to, who they call and give information to, who they decline requests from. All of those things are still there. It's just a limit on the ability to say, hey, press, you can come in. Oh, but you can't come in because I don't like you. That's the limitation we're talking about, is access to a specific piece of property. And they're not being punished like you can't speak. They're just saying you can't come in here. So that's really the issue that we're talking about.
We began this talking about how the origin of this case was AP refusing to change its style book, right? And this conflict this is not the first controversy over the AP style book and the choices that are made there. I'll let you comment if you want to on conflicts that ADF or others may have had with the AP style book and the choices that they've made before, just to illustrate this is not a one-time scenario, but maybe to ask it in the form of a question. Is this essentially like in a future administration, right? If the decision was that the White House, would this be a good hypothetical? Future White House decides that it is not going to allow any journalist to be present in these sort of same spaces in the Oval Office or on the plane or whatever else, if it doesn't use the pronouns the way that that White House has chosen to use those pronouns, right? So if, you know, if Fox News refuses to use the pronouns that they have chosen, they've decreed that those are the proper pronouns, the correct pronouns. And if you won't use those pronouns for, then, you know, that's a fact problem. And it's not an opinion question. This is a factual determination. You're not using the correct facts. Is that and obviously, you know, it's been reproductive health care. There are a number of things that are choices the AP makes that are, you know, both sort of factual determinations and also very much imbued with opinion included.
Yeah, I absolutely think that's a very apt analogy and one that is, you know, very likely to arise. One of the reasons we so zealously protect freedom of the press and the First Amendment is because there are so many different ways to communicate, you know, different things. And one of the things that the AP talks about here is like the quality of the photographs that they got from their photographers, as opposed to, you know, the photographers that are in there now, and how that is able to communicate a message, right? And so the use of pronouns, it communicates a message. If you believe that gender is on a spectrum and it's fluid, then you use everybody's different pronouns, that is communicating a certain message about what you believe about sex and gender. If you say, I'm only going to use biological pronouns, obviously that communicates a different message. Whether you define people as pro-lifers or, you know, anti-abortion, those things all communicate messages. And if the government puts its foot on the levers by saying, we're not going to interact with, or we're not going to allow press in that uses certain types of language, I do think that is going to squelch the reporting on the press. And I think it's important that we make sure that we enforce this requirement of viewpoint neutrality across the board, no matter what administration's in, no matter what issue we're talking about. If the government is giving a benefit and it says, we'll only give you this benefit if you express our viewpoint, obviously that's going to change the analysis, and it's going to hurt, I think, the debate on these really important issues. And so it doesn't really matter whether this issue really isn't about whether it should be called rightly the Gulf of America or the Gulf of Mexico. That's not really the debate. The debate really is, you know, can the government restrict access to reporters, you know, in a certain forum because they don't like that person's views? And here the court said, no, you can't do that. You can do a lot of other things. You know, you can control your message in a lot of other ways. You still get to speak the message you want, government, but you can't open up a forum and then restrict that. And I think, you know, that, you know, it appears that the district court's analysis of that is fairly consistent with the forum analysis that has been developed, you know, over the last 75 to 100 years.
Great. We'll invite Kayla back here. I will just respond to David Chu and say no one has told me that I look like a young version of Sidney Pollack, but I think it's probably the glasses. So if I take them off, that probably helps you. Kayla, floor is yours, but first I just wanted to thank Tyson. Thanks for coming on, preparing, and for walking us through this this opinion. We will still wait to decide to see what the D.C. Circuit says and how this plays out. But I think you have helped to elucidate these questions. Very much so. Kayla, the floor is yours.
I'll echo those thanks. We really appreciate you both joining us today and sharing your expertise and insight on this interesting case. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. Welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.